Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, November 21st, and we're in the middle of the Blood Vessels chapter. That's chapter 20. Okay, so we're just a little bit ahead of schedule, but not too bad. I think we'll appreciate that we have a little extra time at the end of the semester when we talk about the diversification system. So this is time well spent. Anybody have a question about the schedule? Let's see, what are my questions about the schedule? Tomorrow, the campus is closed because it's Thanksgiving. So I know I'm going to forget at the end of class, so happy Thanksgiving before lecture, but that will be tomorrow. And then we just have a couple of weeks left in class, and we're going to go through a couple of these chapters. These chapters are short, okay, except for the reproductive system. That's a little bit longer. All right, so we were talking about blood vessels, and let's go over the three main kinds of blood vessels. We'll just review real fast. What are the three kinds of blood vessels, three main groups?
Arteries,
I like that. Veins, and capillaries, excellent. What's the job of an artery?
Takes
blood away from the heart. And it could be deoxygenated blood, for instance, if it's the pulmonary artery, or it could be oxygenated blood, for instance, if it's the aorta. So it's only the direction that counts. What's the function of a capillary that we see right here?
Exchange,
that's right. That's the only place in the cardiovascular system where things can leave the blood or enter the blood. So if you're going to be absorbing oxygen in the lungs, guess what your lungs need? They need capillaries. They need capillaries. And if oxygen is going to leave the blood in your tissues, like for your heart or brain to get into your tissues, what does your brain and heart need? They need capillaries for exchange, right? They need capillaries. So capillaries is the only place where exchange takes place. But I'm glad you're just answering that question automatically. That's good. All right, so we were talking about naming some blood vessels all over the body, and we were looking in the head last time. And I said there's an important area that is not labeled in your book, but of course you should never take an anatomy class without knowing this because clinically it is so significant. And anatomically it's significant, and physiologically it's significant. All right, so on this diagram we see, I'm going to demonstrate it all over again. So here is the arch of the aorta. And what's the first branch off the arch of the aorta? Okay, whoa, you guys are going to have a short Thanksgiving celebration. I see you're going to be looking for anatomy books on Black Friday. Okay, the first branch off the aorta is the brachiocephalic, and there's neither a right or a left one because there is only one in your body, brachiocephalic artery. There are two brachiocephalic veins, but only one brachiocephalic artery. Okay, and then it bifurcates into the right common carotid and the right subclavian. The common carotid takes blood to the head, and the subclavian takes blood to your upper appendage. Okay. The first branch off the subclavian is an artery that goes through all those interesting landmarks that we learned on cervical vertebrae, and that's the vertebral artery. So that's one of just two arteries on one side of the body, one side of the neck that takes blood to the brain. So that's a very important artery. You never want to lose blood to the brain. All right, the common carotid bifurcates in this area right here that we call the carotid sinus. And that's what I wanted you to label in your books, the carotid sinus, because there's like a little bulge in the carotid artery at this location that contains sensors for blood pressure and oxygen and maybe pH, which is the acidity content of blood. So that's an important monitoring unit for blood pressure. And because of the structure, it has a tendency to get weaker over time and stretch out and maybe form an aneurysm. And as it stretches, it also gets diseased. So there are plaques that like to form in this area that can break off. And when they break off, guess where they can go? Right up into the brain. And if there's a plaque, if there's a thrombus that moves into the brain and blocks off blood supply to part of the brain, what do we call that? What do we call when your brain loses perfusion and loses oxygen? Yeah, that's called a stroke, and that's never a good thing. All right, so this area right here is problematic for humans, the carotid sinus. So there is an internal carotid artery takes blood to the brain, as well as this vertebral, and that's it going to the brain. The external carotid just takes blood everywhere outside of the cranium, including the face. All right, so I wanted, so I think this is an exam figure, but just what I described are just the arteries that I want you to know. I don't want you to know all of these right here, but just the ones that I talked about just now. Okay, so here we have two blood vessels bringing blood to the brain, the internal carotid and the vertebral. And you might say, well, gee whiz, it would be really nice to have a little bit more blood supply to the brain or somehow protect the brain from underperfusion, especially if there's damage to one of those blood vessels, because you don't want to lose your brain that's controlling all of your body. All right, so let's see one little structure that's very adaptive and protective of the brain, and it acts like a plexus. You learned what a nerve plexus is. Okay, what's the function of a nerve plexus? Okay, it's just a network of nerves that, or a couple nerves come in and form a network, and then some more nerves leave that network. So that just means that nerve impulses can take alternate routes to get to important organs. For instance, if one nerve gets damaged, if there are signals that get to the nerve plexus, then you can figure out how to get nerve signals to an important organ, like the diaphragm, for instance, for breathing. So it allows for alternate routes of information to travel if one nerve gets damaged. Well, we're going to see the same kind of structure in the brain. Okay, here is something that's similar to a nerve plexus, but it's a vascular plexus. And again, it allows for blood to take different routes to get around to different parts of the brain, because you never want to have a brain without oxygen. All right, so here were the two vertebral arteries that we looked at on the previous slide. They come together right at the pons to form the basilar artery. All right, so that's kind of funny. So usually we think that these arteries are going to bifurcate or split up to get smaller and smaller, but in this particular case, they join together to form the basilar. Here are the two internal carotid arteries coming from that bifurcation of the common carotid right at the base of the brain, and these things form a circle. And you should probably know some of these different communications between the carotid and the basilar artery, like the posterior, come on cursor, posterior communicating artery between the internal carotid and the basilar artery, and the anterior cerebral artery, right, form a circle, and we call this the circle of Willis. So for instance, if there is an occlusion to your left vertebral artery, right, you would think, well, that's a major part of the brain that's not getting blood when that happens. But because of this plexus, guess what happens? There's blood from the left vertebral artery that can supply that same part of the brain, and there's blood from both carotid arteries that can feed that same part of the brain, because blood can take any different circuitous route through this circle of Willis, and it's also mixed together in the basilar artery. So that really protects our brain quite a bit. That's an important structure at the base of the brain, the circle of Willis right here. All right, so the other important take-home message is that you only have four blood vessels that bring blood to your brain, and those are the two vertebral arteries and the two internal carotids. But blood from any of these can end up in any location within the brain, protecting the brain, because of the circle of Willis. That's some important information. All right, so let's see where we are. Okay, let's look at some upper appendages. Let's see if we can zoom into a region that has some blood vessels on it in the upper appendage without looking at the big diagram. Oh, it's the very next one. Nice. Okay, so here we have a little bit of the aorta. So let me quiz you on this. What part of the aorta is this right here? Uh-oh. Excuse me. Hope you had the volume turned down. Okay, what part of the aorta is this? This is the ascending aorta, okay, and then this part right here is the arch, aortic arch, and then from here all the way down is the, and it's labeled on this diagram so it's not too difficult to tell. That's the descending aorta. And the descending aorta has two divisions. Who can tell me what the divisions are of the descending aorta? Thoracic between the diaphragm and the arch. And then from the diaphragm down to the common iliac is the abdominal aorta, right? So that's the aorta. But we're going to deviate back up to the upper appendage. So here's the subclavian. It goes right underneath the clavicle. And this is why it's a really good thing when the clavicle breaks, which way does it break? to the exterior because of the shape. It has that funny S shape to it, so it never breaks to the inside of the body. If it did, then you'd have these sharp bones lacerating the subclavian artery, and you could hemorrhage to death very quickly as a result of that. So that's important. When the subclavian gets into the axillary region, then we change its name. It becomes the axillary. When it goes into the axilla, or your armpit, we call that the axillary. But then when it gets into your arm, then it becomes the brachial artery. Then down past your elbow, it bifurcates into the radial and ulnar artery, and I won't even show you that because you should know where that is. And then there's another vascular plexus down in the hand that we call the palmar arches. So again, that's just a way that blood can take different routes to get to some important appendages on your body, like your digits. All right, so blood can be shared if there's damage in the forearm to either the ulnar, then the radial artery can supply blood to the rest of the arm and hand, or vice versa. So that's a handy structure to have. All right, so what's next on your list right here? Okay, the aorta is what we're going to talk about. All right, so here we see the thoracic aorta. The thoracic aorta includes the ascending aorta, the arch, as well as the descending aorta. Those are all in the thorax, thoracic cavity. All right, and I don't think we're going to learn any branches off the thoracic aorta, but we're going to learn some branches off the abdominal aorta, which is the distal segment of the descending aorta. Okay, and so let me show you how to approach these arteries coming off the abdominal aorta. All right, and indeed, I want to show to you, prove to you that that is the abdominal aorta, because here is the diaphragm. So here is the abdominal cavity, and here is an opening in the diaphragm that allows the esophagus to move and connect to the stomach. We call that the esophageal hiatus right here. Here is another hiatus in the diaphragm that allows the inferior vena cava to bring blood back up to the heart. So a hiatus is just a hole, okay, in a muscle layer. In this particular muscle is going to be the diaphragm. All right, so here is that descending aorta once again. And sometimes in your body you have a pair of organs. You don't just have one. Sometimes you have one copy of an organ. So who can tell me an organ in your body that you have two of? Because of bilateral symmetry. Kidneys, and we see them right here. There's a right kidney and a left kidney, and so guess what you need? You need a left renal artery and a right renal artery because you have these as a paired organ inside your body. You have other organs that you only have one copy of. You don't need to have two. And who could tell me a name of an organ that you only have one of? You got one heart, this is true, I like that, but since we're in the abdominal cavity, I can't relate it to this diagram very well, but I like that idea. You do have one heart. What in the abdominal cavity do you have one of? We haven't really studied it yet, but maybe before you took this class, you have one stomach, you have one liver, you have one large intestine, you have one small intestine, that's not connected by bilateral symmetry, you just have one of these things. So, if you just have one of an organ, then you have one artery going to it. You don't have two arteries going to it. So when you have paired organs, like the kidney, like the gonads, ooh, who knows what a gonad is? I don't think we talked about that yet. A gonad is a reproductive organ, and you're either going to have a testes or an ovary. Okay, and so women have ovaries, men have testes. And you have two of them, so guess how many arteries you have going to gonads? You got two. You got a right and a left. And indeed, I see the gonadal arteries right here. So they come off the descending aorta pretty superiorly, right? Because your gonads are way down over in this location. Okay. So some of these arteries come off as a single branch. Some come off as paired branches depending on the arrangement of organs inside your abdominal cavity. Let's look at the arteries that come off as a single branch from the abdominal aorta. And there's only three of them. Here's one, here's two, and here's three. First one we have is what we call the celiac trunk. The celiac trunk is going to bifurcate and take blood to the liver. It's going to take blood to the stomach. It's going to take blood to the spleen. All right. So that's why we call it a trunk, because it's a distributing artery, taking blood to each of those organs that you only have one of. All right, the next single branch that comes off is the superior mesenteric. And that's going to go to the small intestine. Maybe parts of it will go to the stomach. Right? And since you have one of those organs, you only have an unpaired branch coming off the descending aorta. And then lastly, and the most inferior, or probably a better way to say it, the most distal one, is the inferior mesenteric, going to the large intestine and urinary bladder and places like that. All right, so the unpaired branches are the celiac trunk, superior mesenteric, and inferior mesenteric. That's all there is to the unpaired branches. And as far as the paired branches are concerned, I think on the list, I'll check the list, but you have the right and left renal arteries going to the kidneys. You have the right and left adrenal or suprarenal arteries because you have two adrenal glands. That may or may not be on your list. I'm not sure. Okay, if it's not, you can ignore it. And then the other ones are that I showed you already are the gonadal arteries going to the right and left gonads, depending on which kind you have right here. And notice these gonadal arteries are located right between the superior and inferior mesenteric artery. All right, so break this down. Break the branches of the aorta into paired and unpaired branches, and I think students have an easier time thinking of it that way. Okay, and you should be aware of them. All right, so let's look and see paired and unpaired branches. Suprarenal is on your diagram. Okay, let's now move down, okay, right to this region right here, and we see that the aorta stops because it bifurcates into two major arteries, and of course this bifurcation is approaching what the two lower appendages, and we call this the common iliac artery. So the aorta, the descending aorta, stops right here, and it forms the common iliac. And then the common iliac is going to bifurcate very soon into these two arteries, and I want to find another picture of that location. Oh, that was awfully pretty. I'm looking at the celiac trunk right here, and you can see the single branches going to the spleen, so that would be the splenic artery. All right, but this is not an exam figure, so I'm going to pass over it pretty quickly to get to, okay, the iliac artery. So here is the common iliac, which bifurcates right off the abdominal aorta, and then the common iliac is going to bifurcate into an internal iliac artery and an external iliac artery. So that's pretty easy to figure out. Okay, and then what else do we have? The iliac, right, the external iliac, then when it gets down into the leg is what we're going to call the femoral artery. All right, so here is the common iliac. Here is the internal, here's the external. When the external gets into the thigh, then we're going to call that the femoral artery. And that same artery, when it gets behind the knee, we're going to call the popliteal artery. Okay, and I think that's it for arteries in the lower appendage. Veins, okay, are going to have pretty much the same name if they're located in the same region of the body. So I don't think I need to describe them to you. For instance, the vein in the thigh right here is going to be the femoral vein. Then here is going to be the iliac vein. Right? But the aorta, okay, the vein that corresponds to the aorta is called the vena cava, great cavernous vein, and it would be the inferior vena cava. So let me see if I can find a nice slide. Right, so here's the common iliac vein. You're going to find that in the same region as the common iliac artery. Okay. Internal iliac vein, that's going to run along the internal iliac artery. So that's pretty easy to tell, except for a couple arteries, and I'll point one out to you. And here is a jugular vein. You don't have a jugular artery, but what kind of arteries do you have in the neck? Yeah, you've got carotid, common carotid artery. All right, so here we do change the name to jugular vein. So here's the internal jugular vein, and here, this is going to be draining blood from the head, including the brain. So when a subclavian vein, and you should know where that is, subclavian vein is draining blood from the upper appendage and some from the vertebral vein. All right, when they join together, jugular and subclavian vein, then we get part of a brachiocephalic vein. And we have both a right and left brachiocephalic vein. I think you saw that in lab on those nice plaques that we have. The brachiocephalic vein then is going to join the brachiocephalic vein from the left side of the body to form the superior vena cava, just like we see over here. All right, let me see if I got some other nice pictures. All right, so here is the internal jugular vein, and blood from the cranium drains into the internal jugular, and we can see, you saw this on a different presentation before, but the superior sagittal sinus, this is what accepts cerebrospinal fluid as it's circulating back to the cardiovascular system. Okay, and then that drains posteriorly into the what we call the confluence of the sinuses. So these are just big veins in the head, and we have a tendency to call these sinuses. And then it forms this little bend right here. We call that the sigmoid sinus. The sigmoid sinus then drains into the jugular. In the more anterior parts of the brain, we have the cavernous sinus, which then drains into the jugular vein. Right, but the brain itself doesn't have very many big blood vessels because you have neurons in that area. Right? There's only small blood vessels, small arteries and small veins. Most of the blood vessels will be right on the surface of the brain. Okay, and you're familiar with the false cerebri, which is that connective tissue that's separating the right and left cerebral hemispheres. It also helps make up part of the superior sagittal sinus. There are some special circulations in the body. And I kind of passed them by already. Okay, the usual kind of circulate. Let me show you what the usual circulation is. So this is a review from the previous lecture. The usual circulation we see right here, okay, which contains three of those types of blood vessels. We have a vessel taking blood away from the heart, which is called an artery. We have a blood vessel taking blood back to the heart that we call a vein. And in between the two, we have blood vessels for exchange, which we call capillaries, right? So this is a typical kind of circulation that you have in 99.999% of your body. You have artery, capillary, and then a vein. But in a couple areas of your body, there is inserted a second capillary bed. There are two capillary beds back to back. And that's the figure that I was about to show you. I'll pull that up right now, which is maybe down over here. Right here. Okay, so here we have an artery bringing blood from the heart to capillaries, right? And here is a blood vessel bringing blood back to the heart. That is called a vein all the time. And then here we have two capillary beds, and capillaries are specialized for exchange. So things can only enter or leave the blood, the circulatory system, if there's a capillary there. Remember, arteries and veins are way too thick. As a matter of fact, arterioles and venules are way too thick to allow for exchange. Only capillaries allow for exchange. And this special circulation with two capillary beds back to back is a special delivery system where the first capillary bed will absorb something and it's delivered via a vein to the second capillary bed where it can be released to tissues in this region right here. So it's a special circulation so that these compounds that get picked up by the first capillary bed don't get diluted in the whole blood volume that you have circulating through your body. Or they don't have to travel through your whole body, okay, before they get to the organ that's going to process them. That's important, for instance, when there are toxins in your digestive tract, right? We don't want those toxins getting into the circulatory system and going directly to the brain. They get passed through the liver first for detoxification. But the only way those chemicals can be absorbed in the digestive tract and delivered to the liver where they can be detoxified is if you have a capillary in the digestive tract and a capillary in the liver, because that's the only site for exchange. This kind of system is what we call a portal system. Whenever there are two capillary beds back to back, that's a portal system, and the vein that's connecting the two capillaries is what we call a portal vein. And in this particular case, since it's going to the liver, what is that term that refers to the liver all the time if you hear it? It could be used in certain parts of words. Hepato, right, or hepatic refers to the liver. So this is what we call the hepatic portal vein because it's a portal vessel going to the liver. And it's a portal vessel because it connects two capillary beds without going back to the heart. Usually a vein takes blood directly back to the heart, but not in this circumstance because there are two capillary beds back to back. Okay, so that's a special system in the body. We're going to learn of a couple special portal systems in the body. And so in your lecture notes, okay, I diagrammed it out kind of as a flow diagram. Here you have the gastrointestinal tract, and you have capillaries in the GI tract for absorbing nutrients, right? And then those nutrients end up in the gastric vein, superior mesenteric vein, inferior mesenteric vein, splenic vein. And those substances should not be just dumped automatically into your cardiovascular system. Those things should be processed. That blood should be processed by the liver first, where toxins can be detoxified. So this blood enters a portal blood vessel, the hepatic portal vein, that takes blood where? Not back to the heart, but to the liver for detoxifying those compounds, where there are liver capillaries, so exchange can take place once again. Those toxins can leave the blood and enter the liver, and part of the job of the liver is to detoxify toxic substances. All right, so then that blood is detoxified, and then it is placed in another vein, like a hepatic vein, which goes to the inferior vena cava. And where does the inferior vena cava take blood? To the heart, and probably you should be thinking of what part of the heart even at this time. What part of the heart? I'll give you a hint. It's a chamber. Right atrium, that's right. So how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does it have?
Four.
And indeed, okay, the systemic circulation ends up in the right atrium and then goes to the right ventricle. And what's the job of the right ventricle? It pumps blood where? Through the pulmonary circulation so that that blood can then pick up oxygen and get rid of CO2. And then you have a pulmonary vein. I don't have a nice diagram right here to show you. You have a pulmonary vein, and we call it a vein because it's taking blood where? To the heart. And where does the pulmonary vein take blood? What part of the heart? How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
What receives blood? What are the two names of two chambers that receive blood? Those are the atria that receive blood, right? And the pulmonary vein gives blood to which of those two chambers? Is it the right atrium or the left atrium? It is the left atrium, which then pumps it into the left ventricle, and the left ventricle pumps blood through the systemic circulation. Okay, and this portal system is part of the systemic circulation, but there are two capillary beds between the aorta and the vena cava. Usually, how many capillary beds are there between the aorta and the vena cava? There's only one, typically, right? This is just one of those special circumstances where there is a portal circulation. Okay. Fetal circulation, you know what? We talked about in lab already quite a bit. Maybe I'll just say a couple little things about it in lecture. Okay, as a review. All right, so here's the circulatory system in the fetus, and that's just a person before they're born. All right, so here is a little baby in utero before they're born. And if somebody is living in the uterus, they don't need to use their lungs because there's no air to breathe inside the amniotic sac anyway. But the baby still needs, or the fetus still needs, oxygen. And there is a structure that takes the place of the lungs and also to some degree the liver. Okay, and that structure is what we call the placenta. And so the placenta is doing the job of the lungs because the maternal lungs are oxygenating blood and delivering oxygenated blood to the placenta, which then is transferred to the fetus. So the fetus has to pump out blood, okay, away from the heart into the placenta. What do we call a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart? Arteries. So here are the two umbilical arteries taking relatively deoxygenated blood to the placenta because the placenta is acting like the lungs. So oxygen goes in, CO2 goes out, and then that blood returns to the fetus from the placenta and actually toward the heart. And what do we call a blood vessel that brings blood toward the heart? A vein. So here is the umbilical vein. You have two umbilical arteries, one umbilical vein. And typically you think of a vein as carrying red, highly oxygenated blood, but not in this particular case because the umbilical circulation or fetal circulation to the placenta is more like which circulation in the adult? How many circulation does an adult have? Has two. Has the pulmonary and has the systemic circulation, because the adult has two sides of the heart, right? It's like having two pumps. So with this umbilical vein right here is more like which vein, a pulmonary vein or a vena cava? Okay, it's more like a pulmonary vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart, and the type of blood that's being carried right here in the umbilical vein is high in oxygen, just like the pulmonary veins are high in oxygen. So think of this fetal circulation as being like the pulmonary circulation in the adult. And indeed, it's doing the job of the pulmonary circulation in the adult. So since the placenta is doing the job of the lungs, guess what? Blood is doing the job of the liver. So blood in this umbilical artery right here really does not need to go to the fetal liver because it's not developed yet. Does it need to go to the lungs because the lungs are not developed yet? So blood goes from the umbilical vein, bypassing the liver through a structure that we call the ductus venosus, which then takes blood away from the liver and empties it right into the vena cava here. All right, so that's its job, the ductus venosus. Okay, and then that takes it back to the right atrium. Okay, and that's the beginning of the pulmonary circulation. But we said that the fetus does not use lungs, so there's not a lot of reason why blood should be pumped to the lungs. All right, so some blood in the right atrium moves directly over to the left atrium through a hole in the interatrial septum. And that hole is what we call the foramen ovale, right? A foramen is just a hole in something. And when blood goes from the right atrium to the left atrium, what organ is it bypassing? It's bypassing the lungs, right? And that's okay in the fetus because their lungs aren't functioning anyway, right? So that's a nice little bypass. And then if some blood does go into the right ventricle, it gets pumped into the pulmonary artery past the pulmonary semilunar valve right here on its way to what organ in the fetus? Where does the pulmonary artery deliver blood to? You all know this. I know you know it. It seems complicated, but it's not. Okay, it's pumping blood to the pulmonary artery is going to supply blood to the lungs because that's the job of the pulmonary circulation. But what about in the fetus? Are the lungs doing anything? They are not. So there's not a whole lot of reason why that blood should go to the lungs. So here is another way that it can then be diverted to your body and not go to the lungs. And that's through a blood vessel that connects the pulmonary artery up to the aorta, bypassing the pulmonary circulation. And that's called the ductus arteriosus. So you have a ductus venosus taking blood, bypassing the liver. And then you have the ductus arteriosus here, which is bypassing the lungs, taking blood directly from the pulmonary artery to the aorta. So those are the special structures in the fetus. So we started with the placenta, then we looked at the umbilical arteries, then we looked at the umbilical vein, bringing oxygenated blood back to the fetus, then the ductus venosus, and we saw the foramen ovale between the atria, and then lastly, the ductus arteriosus, connecting the pulmonary artery with the aorta. So those are special structures in the fetus, and of course, they should go away in the adult, okay, because we don't want to have a hole in the heart. Because in the adult, they actually have to pump blood where? We don't have a placenta. We can't rely on our mother for oxygen anymore. Where do we get oxygen from? How do we get oxygen in our blood? From the lungs. There are pulmonary capillaries, right? So the heart better start pumping blood to the lungs when you're born so that foramen ovale closes over and it becomes a little depression. And a depression in anatomy is called a fossa. So the foramen ovale becomes the fossa ovalis that you can see in the interatrial septum. This ductus arteriosus closes and becomes a ligament. It just becomes the ligamentum arteriosum, right? And you can see that very nicely on our models in lab. And the ductus venosus here becomes the ligamentum venosum. And the umbilical vein, here's the umbilical vein right here, becomes the ligamentum teres. and the umbilical arteries become the medial umbilical ligaments. And what does the placenta become in the adult? Nothing. It's left behind, right? Okay. So the lungs and the liver, the fetal lungs or the neonatal lungs and liver then take over the job of the placenta, which is using the function of the maternal liver and lungs. All right, so that's the fetal circulation. The next figure just shows what these things turn into in the adult. Okay, right here. Okay, so the foramen ovale goes away. Normally it goes away. If it doesn't go away, then it has to be repaired surgically. It has to be closed surgically. All right, so I think that's it for the circulatory system. Who's got some questions about circulatory system? Naming blood vessels. Just always don't get tricked into thinking that because a blood vessel is blue or red, you know if it's an artery or vein. That's not a good definition for an artery or vein. What's the only good definition of an artery? Its direction, which is taking blood away from the heart. That's right. And the definition of a vein that always works is bringing it to the heart. And sometimes it's oxygenated blood, sometimes it's deoxygenated blood. Okay, so that's it for the vascular system. So we got a little time left to play around with the lymphatic system. Okay, so let's see if I can find something about the lymphatic system anywhere. Oh yeah, I got that loaded up already. But I need to find some figures for the lymphatic system. Okay, lymphatic system. The lymphatic system is filled with a fluid that we call what? Lymph. Yeah, you're going to be tired of hearing that term lymph a lot. Because we've got lymph nodes, lymph fluid, lymphatic vessels, right? But it's not a very long chapter. And lymph is kind of a funny term. All right, so I'm going to put this down over here. I'm going to put that away. I'm going to close off blood vessels and look at the lymphatic system. And as we read the word slide, maybe I can show you, okay, this picture right here, which shows some lymphatic tissues in the body. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So what is the composition? What are the structures that make up the lymphatic system? Well, you got the fluid, which is lymph, okay, that flows through this system. You have cells that float around in lymph and also make up the lymphatic organs, right? So you got lymphocytes. And then you have tubes that carry lymph around in your body. We call those lymph vessels. And so here we see some lymph vessels, and then I see some of these little swellings along a lymph vessel. And these are what we call lymph nodes. We'll go over what the function of a lymph node is. But in any case, as lymph is returning back to the cardiovascular system from the periphery, it has to flow through at least one lymph node before it returns to the subclavian artery right here. All right, so lymph will join the cardiovascular system in the subclavian vein. Did I say artery? I might have just said artery, okay? Certainly this is a vein. So lymph rejoins the cardiovascular system at a subclavian vein. And in order for lymph to go from your body back to the subclavian vein, it has to pass through at least one lymph node. The lymph node is a filtering mechanism. We'll look at that in just a second. All right, there are some other lymphatic organs in your body like tonsils. We have those in your oral pharynx and underneath your tongue. Okay, they help fight infection. That's one of the jobs of the lymphatic system. You have the spleen. Here's the spleen. We talk about it a little bit in lab. All right, it's just tucked away underneath the stomach, and it has an important immune function and cardiovascular function as well. And the thymus gland, which is in the mediastinum around the heart. And tell you the truth, I don't see it on this diagram, but where the cursor is about where the thymus gland is going to be located. Okay, so what's the function of the lymphatic system? Well, we see that it has a number of different functions. It maintains fluid balance inside your body. Okay, so let me show you this picture here to talk about why it maintains fluid balance. I think the figure I want to show you is this one right here. All right, so some things on this figure you are familiar with already, because here is a blood vessel and it's nicely labeled with this arrow. It's taking blood away from the heart. So what is this right here? It's an artery. And here's a blood vessel bringing blood back to the heart. So this is a vein. And what kind of structure do we usually have between an artery and a vein for exchange? A nice capillary. Nice, and this is a nice systemic capillary someplace in your body feeding a muscle or your heart or your brain. Okay. So a capillary can be very leaky. It can leak fluid. It can leak plasma into the interstitial space between cells. And most of the fluid leaves a capillary at the proximal end of a capillary. A lot of fluid leaves. Okay, and then at the distal end, some of that fluid is returned to the distal end of a capillary, and it's returned to your cardiovascular system. All right, but let's look at these figures over here. 30 liters of plasma pass out of a capillary each day in your body. So what's a big bottle of Coca-Cola? How many liters is that? That's two, right? So it's more than 10 times that fluid leaves your cardiovascular system, okay, to perfuse these tissues right here. But only 27 liters get picked up by the distal end of the capillary, right? And 3 liters then is left, remains in the tissue. So every day, how much would your body swell up, right, if that fluid remained in tissues? You started with 30, 27 get resorbed, right? Your body would swell up every day by the size of 3 liters. And then the next day, your body would be 6 liters bigger, and then 9 liters bigger, and 12 liters bigger, and then finally what would happen to you? Well, you would just explode in this big mess of extracellular fluid all over the floor, all right? So that doesn't happen. And the reason why that doesn't happen is because there's another vascular system that is very similar to a vein. There's another vascular system that brings that extracellular fluid back to the heart. And what do we call a vessel that brings blood back to the heart? That's a vein. So these lymphatic vessels are acting like a vein, returning that excess extracellular fluid back to the heart, and that prevents you from swelling up. So that's the job of one of the jobs of the lymphatic system, right? It maintains fluid balance. It returns fluid to your cardiovascular system for two reasons: so that you don't swell up, but also so that you don't dehydrate, and so that you can maintain blood pressure. If you were to lose that fluid in your tissue spaces, then okay, you would dehydrate very, very quickly because that fluid would be lost to the cardiovascular system. All right, so that's an important function of the lymphatic system. Another important function is that it absorbs fat from the gastrointestinal tract. We'll see where that is in lab. It's a structure within a villus, and as a matter of fact, I don't have a picture within a lymphatic system, but you'll see what that little thing is. It's called a capillary, right? That capillary is a lacteal. So when fat is absorbed into a lacteal, it kind of makes a milky white fluid that we call chyle, right? And then that fat is processed within the lymphatic system. Okay, so here we have some lymphatic vessels that are picking up extracellular fluid. So this is a site for exchange. Here's a vessel that is accepting fluid from the extracellular space. So what do we call a vessel that's specialized for exchange? A capillary. Here is a capillary that has blood in it, but here is a capillary that has lymph in it, so this is what we call a lymphatic capillary instead of just a regular old usual capillary. Let me show you a picture of a lymphatic capillary. Oh, I better just go directly to it. All right, so here's a lymph capillary. And why is it that it can accept extracellular fluid? So here is just the end of a lymph blood vessel, right? And it's specialized for exchange, so it's a capillary, but it's a lymphatic capillary. Here are some mini valves between the endothelial cells that make up a lymph capillary, and they kind of flop open and they kind of flop close. And when they flop open, extracellular fluid enters this capillary. So these lymphatic capillaries are like gulping extracellular fluid all day long, right? And then that fluid starts to flow back to the heart, and it flows back to the heart the same way blood in a vein flows back to the heart. We learned of two pumps that return venous blood back to the heart because there's very low pressure in a vein. And can anybody remember what the two pumps were? I'll say them. I don't have a picture anymore of them. It is what? The skeletal muscle pump. Every time a skeletal muscle contracts, it compresses a lymphatic vessel, and that pressurizes the lymph, and it's going to squirt up to the heart. It's not going to squirt back down to the periphery. So there's a structure inside a lymphatic vessel that veins have and arteries do not have. Does anybody know what I'm trying to get at? And that is, right, whenever you want flow going in one direction, you have to put a valve in that structure, like the heart or the vein. Lymphatic vessels do have valves as well to make sure that lymph only goes back to the heart. When a skeletal muscle squeezes on that blood vessel, it gets squirted back to the heart. And then the second pump that works for the venous system, right, as well as the lymphatic system, is what we call the respiratory pump. Okay? Anytime we expand our thoracic cavity, not only does air rush inside our thorax into our lungs, but fluid in our body rushes into the thorax as well, including lymphatic tissue. So the skeletal muscle pump and the respiratory pump make sure that lymphatic fluid returns to the heart. Okay? And it also has valves in it. I don't have a nice picture of a valve, but they're going to look exactly like they are in veins that we saw in the previous chapter. Okay, so now I think maybe we can start to talk about some of the, one last function of the lymphatic system, and this is hugely important. It's the self-defense system of the body. All right, so it protects you from infection, protects you from invasion of microorganisms, maybe even toxins that get into your body. Maybe you've been stung by an insect or a snake or something. Okay, so it can help protect you from venoms as well. And part of the immune system is a lymph node. It filters lymph on the way back to the heart because it contains lymphocytes that can absorb infectious particles like bacteria and fungi. And then the lymphocytes can kill those particles, for instance, if it's a bacteria, and then develop an immune response to fight that infection by producing antibodies and other kinds of cells that will kill those bacteria. All right, so that's done in a lymph node. And the spleen is another lymphatic organ that does the same thing, except it does it for blood, not lymph necessarily. And the spleen has another function in that it is also, since it's filtering blood, it's looking for old and damaged red blood cells and can get rid of them, help process those red blood cells. All right, so that's the spleen right here. And you can see lymph nodes everywhere in the body, especially in the axilla, okay, especially in the inguinal region right here. There is an aggregation of lymph nodes that are superficial, very close to the integument, right, as well as the cervical region right here. So if somebody has an infection, these lymph nodes start to fight that infection and they swell up and they maybe get a little bit painful, but somebody that's educated, like a physician, would be able to palpate somebody's neck to feel for what? Enlarged lymph nodes. And that's an indication of an infection in the neck or throat or maybe even in the brain. Okay? They could palpate your axillary lymph nodes and inguinal lymph nodes to kind of just get a gauge of whether that infection is a systemic infection or is it localized to one side of the body or both sides of the body or one limb, all right, or maybe just your neck. Okay, so that is interesting that these lymph nodes are there. Okay, so lymph begins in a lymph capillary. That's just a simple squamous epithelium. All right, and then it goes back to the body by anastomosing with other lymphatic vessels, and then muscle contraction and respiratory movements move that lymph back to the heart. And how come it doesn't go back down to the periphery ever? Like if you were to contract these, right, this nice extensor or flexor digitorum longus right here. How come it doesn't get squished back down to your digits? Because there are valves that prevent that from happening in the normal circumstance. So it always makes its way back to the heart. And before it gets to the heart, it's got to rejoin the cardiovascular system. Okay, let me see. All right, so here, let me tell you a couple more structures. Okay, so here is what we call the thoracic duct. And over here, we have the right lymphatic duct. Here we have the right lymphatic duct. And then when we look at this whole person, we see some really strange asymmetry. All right, so here we have the body kind of shaded in like a beige color. How did I do? Green. Isn't that beige? No. Okay. So a green color. And then over on this side of the body is shaded in, looks kind of like red to me. Pink. Really good. Okay, but notice that pink shading includes the left side of the head, the left thorax, the left arm, right? But what about the trunk, like the abdominal region? Both the left and the right, and both right and left lower appendages drain into the thoracic duct, which takes lymph back to the heart. Okay, but the thoracic duct only drains lymph from the right side of the head, the right thorax, and the right upper appendage. So there's a lot of asymmetry. So the lymphatic duct drains a lot less lymph back to the cardiovascular system compared to the thoracic duct that we have right here. All right, so the thoracic duct is really returning lymph from most of the body back to the cardiovascular system. All right, so now I want to zoom in and look at the entrance to the cardiovascular system from the thoracic duct. So here you see the thoracic duct joining the subclavian vein. That is a thoracic duct joining the left subclavian vein. And here's the right lymphatic duct emptying lymph into the left subclavian vein. All right, so that lymphatic fluid indeed is returned to the cardiovascular system or toward the blood so that your blood volume doesn't change. That's important. Okay, and so from the periphery, lymph then travels back to the subclavian vein, but it's filtered by something. What is it filtered by? By at least one lymph node, and in some cases, it could be filtered by many, many lymph nodes, right, to protect your body from infection. Okay, but at least one. All right, so these lymph vessels prevent the swelling, for instance, of an arm, okay, or a side of your head because it's returning lymphatic fluid back to the blood. But what happens if somebody has surgery in some part of the body, for instance, and those lymph vessels are removed? Because remember, one of the job of lymphatic vessels is to filter lymph and remove cells and other kind of materials that's in that lymph. So for instance, if somebody has breast cancer and all of those lymphatic vessels are removed because the cancer has moved into the lymphatic system, and maybe even some of these lymph nodes right here are removed as well, because during the surgery some good pathologist did a histological section of these lymph nodes and found cancer in these lymph nodes right here, so these lymph nodes are removed. Right? So what happens to this region of that person's body when these lymphatic vessels are removed? What's one of the consequences? One of the side effects, which is not a good side effect, because these lymphatic vessels are there for a purpose, and that purpose now has been stopped, has been terminated. What happens to that side or that area of that person's body? Yeah, then it has a tendency to swell up, and we call that edema. Right? So if there's disruption of any of these lymphatic vessels, anything distal to that, then will have a tendency to swell up. Okay, but I'm sure everybody, given the choice, what would you rather have? Swelling in this area or cancer? Yeah, swelling. Okay, until we can figure out a way to counteract that. Okay, so the right lymphatic duct and the thoracic duct are the main ducts that return lymph to the subclavian vein. Okay, some lymphatic organs. I want to just say one last thing before I let you go today, maybe a little bit early. Okay, and we're going to look at this slide here. So you saw some important lymphatic organs, and some are not on this slide. So you saw the spleen, you saw lymph nodes. What you don't see on this slide right here are tonsils, which are in the oral cavity. Tonsils are part of the lymphatic system that fight infection, fight bacteria that are trying to get into your body from your nasal cavity and oral cavity. Right? And they function kind of like lymph nodes. They help fight infection. Sometimes they get infected too, just like these lymph nodes. Right? And then we call that a tonsillitis, for instance. Sometimes somebody will have a tonsil that is chronically infected in the back of their throat, okay? And so sometimes people will have a sore throat, maybe instead of maybe 3 times a year or 4 times a year, maybe twice a month. Okay, not guaranteed to happen, but if you have a chronically infected tonsil, you could have a sore throat and it could be really severe for one day where you miss work one day a week. What would that be like? Well, that's a real pain, right? Because who can afford not to have a salary or earn money one day a week, twice a month, right? So, and then every month that happens. And not only do you leave work, but you feel miserable as well. So what happens in that case is that those tonsils can be removed. That part of the lymphatic system can be removed, and that removes the infection. And people usually do really, really well with that when that happens, and they go from having a sore throat maybe twice a month to maybe once a year. So that really changes their life, like overnight. That's amazing. That's a good surgery to have. The downside is, if you're young, when you get a tonsillectomy, you can recover from that in just a couple of days. Right, but a tonsil in an adult is about as big as your fingertip, and when that's removed, then you have a hole in your throat that big. So if you were to make a hole in your hand that big, how would it feel the next day? Pretty miserable, really, really sore, right? I mean, humans just really can't tolerate that kind of pain very well, okay? So as an adult, when somebody has a tonsillectomy, you're out of work for 2 weeks, which is pretty amazing. When you get a gallbladder removed, you're out of work for like one day, and that's it, and then you go back to work. But a tonsillectomy, 2 weeks, because you're really kind of knocked out of circulation for a while. But is that surgery worthwhile? Yeah, if you can trade off getting a sore throat twice a month, right, for maybe once or twice a year, that's a really good surgery to have. But you got to have some time off. It's relatively more difficult in an adult compared to a child. Okay, but it certainly can change people's lives around. It's really a nice thing. Okay, so you might be asking, well, gee whiz, what happens to your immune system when we start to remove some parts of your body, like your tonsils? Okay, there is something called the appendix, which is part of the large intestine, which is also lymphatic tissue that fights infection. Sometimes people get an appendicitis, and that appendix has to be removed. Just like when somebody has tonsillitis chronically, the tonsils are removed. Right? So you might be wondering, what happens to a person's immune system when we remove an appendix? Because that's important lymphatic tissue. Otherwise, it probably wouldn't be there. Also, remember the spleen. When we talked about the spleen, what kind of connective tissue is the spleen made out of? Okay, dense regular connective tissue, elastic, cartilage, okay. All right, I'll refresh your memory, though I see some people saying it in the back of the room right there. Oh, you're raising your hand. Oh, you're not paying attention, okay. It is what? It's reticular connective tissue. And what can you tell me about reticular fibers? They're very, very weak compared to collagen and even compared to elastic tissue. So when the spleen experiences trauma, it has a tendency to rip open, and it's highly vascular, so it will hemorrhage profusely. And so then we would, what do we do for a laceration that's bleeding? What do we like to do, like on your skin? Suture it together. But the spleen doesn't have any collagen fiber, so as soon as you place a suture in the spleen, guess what happens? It rips more, and you bleed more as a result. All right, so a lot of times after a traumatic accident, the spleen has to be removed, or a part of it. And since it's important lymphatic tissue, your question might be, is somebody immunosuppressed as a result of that? Is somebody immunosuppressed when they lose part of their spleen or part of a tonsil or part of an appendix or even maybe part of a lymphatic system right here when it's removed surgically? And the answer is not terribly so, because not only do you have these organs that are important lymphatic organs, you have lymphatic tissue everywhere in your body, and that tissue everywhere in your body, okay, that we find that will take over the job of those organs that are missing is called mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue or lymphoid tissue, or for short, we're just going to call it MALT. Okay, so anywhere there's a mucosa membrane, it's going to be loaded with lymphatic tissue that can fight infection. And it can usually take over the job of the appendix when it's removed, right? It can take over the job of the tonsils when it's removed, okay? And most times can take over the job of the spleen when it has to be removed. It's only under certain circumstances that somebody has to consider losing part of the spleen or some part of their lymphatic system, and that is when a prosthesis is placed in your body after a surgery. Like, for instance, if somebody needs an artificial hip and somebody's implanted with a nice metal hip right here, or if some other things are left in, surgical clips or other kinds of pieces of bones, like screws to hold bones together, then if somebody is missing a spleen, then they're at a much higher risk of post-operative infection as a result. All right, so that's really the only consideration that one person would have. And that's really mostly only for the spleen, not if you get a tonsillectomy. That probably has no effect one way or the other. So there is some immunosuppression, but not very much at all. All right, so we're going to come back after Thanksgiving and talk some more about these lymphatic organs and probably move on to the next chapter. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Talk to you later.